A new year, a new decade, and a new question. Can the U.S. avoid a new war? On Insight, in our first show of 2020, Ken Rudin, the political junkie on President Trump's Iran decisions, the possibility of war, and what all of this might mean in this U.S. election year. Then, Ben Adler, with a new job at Cap Radio this year, but he's going to join us for one last conversation about his nearly 10 years of covering California politics. How did working under the Capitol Dome change in that time? Later, a clown from Cirque du Soleil from the show Amaluna. She is Kelsey Custard. She's a Sacramento native, one of the few women who has been cast as a clown. We'll talk about that. And Kelsey's brought her castmate with her, Vladimir Pestov. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight and our first show of 2020. I'm Beth Ruyak. Are we beginning this year, this new decade, on the brink of a new war? In Tehran, you might have seen or heard the scenes, reporters saying 1 million people or more are in the streets. They're wearing black, carrying signs, and chanting. The procession and funeral continues for the Iranian military general Soleimani and the others who were killed in last week's drone strikes by the U.S. Let's start the hour with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Ken joins us from the Washington, D.C. area. And it's always the first Monday of every month. It happens to be the first Monday in a new year. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Beth. I was about to say Happy New Year. I'm not sure if it's a Happy New Year.
Well, so I think, what did we have, 36 hours or maybe 48 before the world changed? Now we have the escalating tension in Iran and Iraq, also the backdrop of these massive wildfires in Australia. So I think any sense of calm has disappeared, at least for many of us. What are you thinking as this week begins?
Well, I'm not sure if I ever thought about the word calm, because going into the new year, we knew that there would be an impeachment trial, or we assume it's an impeachment trial, and an election. And if that was not enough to upset everybody, because it's not going to be a fun year. The two parties are still at odds regarding the impeachment. We know how divisive the election is going to be, especially if the Democrats ever come up with a nominee to face President Trump. So when you have the prospect of a widening war emanating out of the Middle East, it's going to be a very volatile year. So maybe it's happy volatile year, not happy new year.
Will you dip back into history a bit and talk about presidents who are in the situation of running for re-election and either intentionally or because of circumstances ending up in an international incident, to say the least?
Well, there are many in history. I mean, you could go back to 1952. You want to start back that far ago, when just shortly before the 1952 election, Dwight D. Eisenhower said, "I will go to Korea to stop the two-year-old conflict there." And that gave him a big boost in his ultimate election against Adlai Stevenson. In 1964, not long before the election, not that Lyndon Johnson was going to lose to Barry Goldwater, but there may have been a manipulated crisis in the Gulf of Tonkin that, if nothing else, Congress voted to authorize it. And we can get to that in a little bit about the role of Congress. In 1968, 5 days before the election, Lyndon Johnson stopped the bombing over North Vietnam that basically helped Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate. And in 1972, I always think of Henry Kissinger saying we have peace is at hand in Vietnam, even though it wasn't at hand. So, in other words, presidents, not even before elections, I mean, think of right as Bill Clinton is going through an impeachment in 1998, he bombs Iraq and he pushed off the debate in the House over impeachment by 2 days because of the bombing in Iraq. So whether it's impeachment or an election, foreign policy does have a way of influencing the results, or at least attempting to influence the results.
You used an interesting word, and that was manipulated. So we can talk a bit about that, but let's bring it more present day. When President Obama was in the midst of his reelection campaign, there was a man who posted a video about the decision pending or posed before President Obama regarding Iran. And this is ironic at this point in time. Why don't you give us a little more context? Because the man who posted the video was none other than Donald Trump.
Well, ironic or ironic, whatever you want, the way you want to pronounce it. That's the irony. If you think of all the things that Donald Trump has said about Barack Obama, that what Barack Obama was about to do or going to do or planning to do, somehow the president, the current president, President Trump, has done the same thing. When Donald Trump is talking about that maybe Barack Obama is trying to manipulate the country into a war with Iran, of course, that never happened. And in fact, President Obama signed this agreement on limiting nuclear proliferation with Iran. Of course, the President Trump has undermined that and gotten rid of that. But the fact is that all the threats of war that Donald Trump warned about when President Obama was in office seems to have come to the realization now, at least with the killing of Soleimani.
There's a YouTube video that you posted on social media. We're going to listen to about a 30-second clip of it. This is back in 2011. And you're going to hear Donald Trump's voice. He uses the words "our president," so he's referencing right away President Obama at that point in time.
Our president will start a war with Iran because he has absolutely no ability to negotiate. He's weak and he's ineffective. So the only way he figures that he's going to get reelected, and as sure as you're sitting there, is to start a war with Iran. Now, I'm more militant and more militaristic than the president. I believe in strength. But to start a war in order to get elected, and I believe that's going to happen, would be an outrage.
It's almost unbelievable to hear those words, isn't it?
It is. It almost, like, if you didn't hear the voice, you would think we were making this up. But the president, if nothing else, President Trump is unpredictable. And I mean, you could say that the critics say he's unstable and erratic and things like that. Certainly he's volatile. And while he was elected in 2016, promising to withdraw from the Middle East and limit U.S. Involvement in these wars, it's very possible. But again, it's a possibility that the killing of Soleimani could lead to greater conflict. But who knows? I think we're wrong to predict anything. Remember when the U.S. moved its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in Israel? A lot of Democrats and a lot of critics of Trump said this is going to cause unrest in the Middle East. And that didn't happen. So we don't know what's going to happen. Maybe Iran is so stunned by Trump's unpredictability that they'll be almost impotent in responding. Most people don't think that at all. A lot of people are pointing to what the Ayatollah said, and that America can expect more deaths, more casualties, and more repercussions from this action.
So I want to reiterate that clip was Donald Trump in 2011 talking about then President Barack Obama, who was campaigning for his second term. One difference here is that we're being told, Ken, that these drone attacks were in response to imminent danger. It's still been undefined. And I don't know at what point or in what way Congress can compel the full disclosure of what the situation was.
That's a big question, and it's an important question, because it's clear that President Trump has shown no desire to cooperate or consult with Congress at all. Whatever you think about George W. Bush's incursion into Iraq, the fact is he went before Congress. Congress gave him the authorization in both the House and Senate. We'll see whether there's going to be a vote at all. But obviously, Democrats are angry. Democrats are asking for what kind of imminent danger did Soleimani present. Now, the Republicans will say, rightfully so, that Soleimani was responsible for the death of hundreds of American soldiers, and that's why that needed to stop. But again, does killing Soleimani change the crisis odds, and does it change the threat from Iran? And that's really very questionable.
So there are two bills. You just spoke about this in general terms. There's a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate that would propose that congressional approval has to happen before we enter into any war at this point. But
the bill eventually has to go to the president's desk. He would be unlikely to sign it, right? So is this legislation going to go anywhere?
Well, first of all, you're already assuming that it passes the Senate. And right now, given the fact that the Senate has seemed to be in lockstep with the president, even though some Republicans are warily responding to the actions over the weekend, but there's no evidence that the Republicans in the Senate are going to pass anything like that. So maybe even if it does pass the House, which is expected, it may die in the Senate and there may be no piece of legislation for the president to sign at all.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ken Rudin, the political junkie. This is our first conversation of this new year. When we left the old year, Ken, we had House Speaker Nancy Pelosi holding the articles of impeachment. There's been this dance about witnesses and how a Senate trial might unfold. All of this is out of the immediate spotlight, especially today with the funeral happening in Tehran. But where do we go from here on the trial?
Well, first of all, even before we get that far, it's so fascinating to me, but predictable as well, to see Republicans, Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader from California, has said this as well, and a lot other Republicans have as well. And they say that, how do you remove a president from office when this president is busy removing terrorists from around the world? And that seems to be the Republican argument. But nothing has really changed regarding the impasse over what to do with the Senate trial about President Trump once impeachment has been finalized in the House. Nancy Pelosi has not sent over the articles of impeachment, as is customary, because she's tried to get Mitch McConnell to agree on some kind of admission of witnesses or documents, produce some documents from the White House. But as long as Donald Trump refuses to allow anybody from the administration to testify, including his chief of staff, his secretary of state, his vice president, people like that, then nothing's going to change. So the only thing that the Democrats could do regarding impeachment is to pick off some Republicans who may be in some jeopardy in 2020's elections. Maybe Susan Collins of Maine, maybe a Cory Gardner of Colorado, maybe Martha McSally of Arizona. Get them to demand some kind of agreement by McConnell if the trial is going to happen. But right now, the Republicans, for the most part, seem to be in lockstep with their majority leader.
So what do you think, Ken? Do you think this action by the president was a response to an imminent threat? Do you think it is an effort to guarantee in some way his reelection? Do you think it was thrown out as a distraction from the impeachment process?
Those are legitimate questions, but I don't think it's possible for us to even answer it, because you have to go into the mind of Donald Trump, and that is always a dangerous suggestion or situation to get yourself involved in. We've been talking about distractions for the longest time. Just like when Bill Clinton bombed Iraq right before the impeachment, people said, in 1998, people said that was a distraction. As far as the election, look, the election is still 10 months away, and things are going to change in the interim. We still don't even have a Democratic nominee yet. But it's just part of his unpredictability, and whether it leads to a rally around the president effort, as we've seen with previous foreign policy debacles, or it turns more and more people against him. It's just too soon to say. But whether it's about impeachment or his election, it just could be the fact that he's a very impulsive president, and he was angry about the killing of an American contractor in Iraq, and he decided to do what Obama and George W. Bush would not do, take out General Soleimani.
Hmm. So let's spend a few minutes here at the end on the Democrats and their reaction. It's been a mix of acknowledging the role and the kind of person that General Soleimani was, and the characterizations of the action that Trump took. This is going to be the main topic now on the campaign trail, superseding everything else. Tom Steyer is the last Californian standing in the midst of this race, and also one of the battle of the billionaires. So what's the race look like?
Well, that's, you know, something, not much has really changed. Nationally, Joe Biden still has the lead. Bernie Sanders still has raised more money than anybody else. In the last quarter, he raised $34.5 million. That is $10 million more than the runner-up, Pete Buttigieg. Right now, only five Democrats have qualified for the January debate, which is next Tuesday. Biden, Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar, who don't count her out yet in Iowa, even though she's not in the top three or four. But right now, Pete Buttigieg has the lead in Iowa. Elizabeth Warren, who, by the way, was endorsed today by Julian Castro. Elizabeth Warren has the lead in New Hampshire. And then Joe Biden has the lead in Nevada and South Carolina. So it could be a very muddled Democratic field, at least going up to Super Tuesday, when California and all those other states vote on March 3rd. And while that's happening, for example, on the next debate is scheduled for the, I guess, what was it scheduled for? The January 14th debate.
Right.
But that may be put off because of possible impeachment trial. So we don't know. While the Democrats are still in flux, President Trump is going around having his rallies. He's having a rally on the 14th in Milwaukee, in Wisconsin, one of the key states for 2020. While the Democrats are eating their own, or at least trying to come up with a nominee, President Trump is raising money and raising the temperature with his rallies. And the Democrats still have a long way to go before they unite behind a candidate.
So Julian Castro did drop out of the race, just to clarify that point. We've got,
right,
as you said, this January debate. There's another debate just before the Iowa caucuses on February 3rd. And the qualifications on the debates keep getting tighter, so the field could narrow even more.
Well, that's true. I think that's one of the reasons Julian Castro got out. I mean, first of all, he was widely criticized for almost mocking Joe Biden's age and memory in one of an earlier debate, and he never seemed to recover from that. But when you think of the Democratic field and all the diversity there, with Kamala Harris and Cory Booker and Julian Castro, now Cory Booker is still in the race, but he's not part of the January debate. It seems it's at least it's five people, and all white people. If Andrew Yang doesn't make it into the debate, so far he's not qualified for the debate, and so it's not turning out the way we expected. But nothing is turning out the way we expected, and I think any kind of predictions is a fool's errand, because there's so much days and so many events yet to come.
All right. I know that this is the kind of year that you live for.
Can I just say one thing? I know you want to look quick, but quickly, at this time in 2012, the Republican leader in the polls for the nomination was Newt Gingrich.
Wow.
In 2008, the Republican leader was Rudy Giuliani. So even as late as January, frontrunners don't necessarily mean the ballgame. Sorry.
No, I'm glad you added that, because it's a reminder of history that we sometimes gloss over when we're so caught up in the moment. And I was just saying, this is the kind of year that you live for. And right now, with so much happening in the world, I think people are perhaps more engaged and more attentive than they might have been in January. So I look forward to many conversations with you this year, Ken. Happy New Year. Happy is a relative word there, but Happy New Year.
If you listen to the Golden Globes yesterday, everybody said, you've got to vote. And that's the answer. You've got to vote.
Yeah. All right, Ken, you take care. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Beth.
Ken Rudin is the political junkie. He joins us on the first Monday of every month. Up next, you're going to hear an echo of that make sure you vote from our Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. But he's transitioning in his work, too. So stay with us. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak with new conversations in a new year. California lawmakers are back in session in Sacramento today. By the end of this week, we're expecting a new state budget. So typically, our Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler, would be quite busy right now, but this is a different year. Ben's put his Capitol beat in the rearview mirror, so to speak. He's starting the new year with a new position at Cap Radio that we'll talk about in just a moment. For now, though, he's in the studio with me with a few reflections on what has been nearly 10 years of covering California politics. Hello.
Hi, Beth.
Happy New Year
and
to you. Is it strange to be here today and not down in session?
A little bit. Because session starts this afternoon, typically I'd be here anyway and then going downtown.
That's
true.
I'd
probably be doing both, and now it's just one.
Let's go back, though, a decade, and give me a sense of place as you started this job. And, of course, you were full of the wonder of where you were going to be working, who you were going to be working with. But tell me more about the atmosphere among the legislature.
When I first covered the state capitol, and this happened about a month after Jerry Brown's return to the governor's office in 2011 after several decades out, it really was the beginning of a new era and a pivot point at the state capitol. You had, of course, a new governor and a governor in a new political party succeeding Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger. You had at that point a $25 billion budget deficit that grew to $27 billion before any initial cuts were made. And then you had the start of negotiations. Governor Brown and Democrats hoped that Republicans would agree to place a tax extension measure on a special election ballot. And in exchange, they were dangling things such as regulatory reform, pension reform, and a budget reserve, a spend. I don't think it was a spending cap per se, but it was, you know, some cap on spending that, you know, some mechanism of keeping spending from growing too high. That negotiation did not play out. It blew up a couple of times that March and then that June. And in the end, there was no special election. The taxes did expire. And then there were the tax increases that had been approved under Governor Schwarzenegger did expire. And then the Democrats went the ballot route themselves. They gathered signatures and they ended up succeeding relatively narrowly, but succeeding in passing Proposition 30, which led to, along with a couple of other big things, led to the end of the state's persistent budget deficits. The recession went away. The economy grew. That's the biggest thing. And since then, as the economy has boomed, there's been no shortage of cash in coffers. And so the times have obviously changed. But when I took over, in that moment, there was a great deal of uncertainty about California's future.
So here we are now in California being more in a state of resistance than it had been then. The new governor is Gavin Newsom. President Trump is in Washington. What's the biggest shift or change besides the people in charge?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the biggest shift is the fact that the state has no shortage of money. And it will not always be the case. People have been warning. We have a chart, one of Jerry Brown's old budget charts in our newsroom that the Sacramento Press Club auctioned off as Brown moved on about a little over a year ago. And, he had this famous quote of what he saw ahead. This is as he released his final budget 2 years ago this week. What's ahead? Well, it's, destruction and devastation. So good luck, baby, to the next governor, Gavin Newsom, who then inherited a $21 billion budget surplus and was able to propose a have your cake and eat it too budget. We're not quite at that phase right now. Money is starting to become a little tighter. You're looking not at a $21 billion surplus, but as Newsom will likely propose this week, you know, a single-digit surplus. And a lot of that is one-time money, and a lot of it is not recommended for permanent spending. So the biggest change, other than, of course, you know, personalities, and you've got, the president going from Obama to Trump, and you've got the governor going from Brown to Newsom. You have Democrats with giga majorities at the Capitol. They're not just supermajorities. They are well above supermajorities, particularly in the assembly. Setting aside people, the biggest change is the state's financial shape. It is night and day.
What's the corollary between a budget being tight or debt being high and the amount of infighting among legislators compared to easier times when money is flowing more freely and individual lawmakers are getting a little more of what they want? How does that measure of fighting stack up?
I would say there are two answers. I mean, the first is the obvious one, that there is a corollary. The second is it's a little more nuanced because personalities do come into play. And lawmakers know when the money isn't there that they're not going to be able to make investments in things they want to invest. They're instead fighting to minimize cuts in their own priority areas. And then a lot of times everyone's seeing their priority areas cut. And then as money starts to come back, it's which areas do you reinvest in or restore budget cuts to first? And then as you kind of get past that step, in the past few years, it's been, okay, new investments. Which areas are going to be prioritized for new investments? So obviously, when money is tight, there's a measure of pragmatism and realism. As money is available, then you do have some more infighting about, you know, well, do you fund childcare or after-school programs?
Right.
A lot of times you have to choose between the two.
You talk to individual lawmakers about this tone of agreement or disagreement about negotiating or not being able to. Let's get specifically to that.
Sure. And what I was just talking about to your last answer was largely, you know, the disagreement among Democrats, because right now we have full Democratic control of the state capitol. What we're now kind of pivoting to is whether Democrats and Republicans, to what extent Democrats and Republicans are able to get along. And it's not like everyone, you know, everything was kumbaya. You know, when I took over, you had those persistent budget deficits. There was a lot of pressure from each party's base that, you know, for example, prevented that compromise that we were talking about a little bit ago about in 2011, trying to get some Republicans and some Democrats to make some budget cuts and put a tax extension measure on a special election ballot. But I do think the polarization in California has deepened to some extent since President Trump took over, and that's true of both sides. And then at the same time, you also have examples of compromise here in California to a greater extent, I think, than you're seeing nationally. Mm-hmm. We've got a clip from the Cordial Caucus Karaoke Party, which is an annual event that current and former lawmakers of all sides and stripes. And of course, you have Democrats and Republicans. But within Democrats, when you've got such a big block, you've got liberal Democrats and moderate Democrats. And sometimes the harshest tensions are between them. But you have all of these folks getting together once a year at a karaoke night at the legendary institution that is Simon's on 16th Street in Midtown
Simon's.
Sacramento. I spoke in February 2017, just a couple of weeks after the inauguration of President Trump, with former Republican State Senator Tony Strickland. And we were talking about how, you know, lawmakers do know how to disagree without being disagreeable.
If you really want stability, you need to hear what the other side's talking about and have some respect.
But your constituents, your active ones, are pressuring you to go further in one direction or another.
Without question. That's why it's incumbent upon leaders to lead.
Leaders to lead sounds in that translation that he means less firepower and more talk.
Yeah, or at least less sniping, I would
say.
You know, maybe just not sniping back at each other quite as much. And it's true that, you know, there's a lot of passionate debate, and nobody is suggesting that you shouldn't get on the floor and passionately debate an issue. The question is whether you need to get personal while you do it. Mm. And I think that's true. I am making the argument, and I very rarely, if ever, advocate for anything. But I am making the argument in my Reporter's Notebook piece online and on air today and right here that it is not just politicians and leaders who need to perhaps take a look at whether they could disagree without being disagreeable, but all of us. Regular people at holiday dinner tables, at PTA meetings, wherever you might be in the shopping. You know, if you see someone wearing a Make America Great Again hat at the grocery store, or you see someone wearing a resistance pin somewhere, there's more to that person, or maybe they have a reason for their political views, and maybe it's worth engaging with them. But that's the argument that I would make is, and I think, you know, we heard Tony Strickland say it's incumbent upon leaders to lead. I think that's true, but it's also incumbent on the rest of us too.
You're listening to Ben Adler. He has been Cap Radio's award-winning Capital Bureau Chief, but now he has a new job title. So let's talk about that for a moment. The new position is still at Cap Radio, which everybody's very happy about, but it includes the phrase program director. What are you going to be doing?
So essentially, I'll be responsible for the sound of the station across all well, we call them platforms and radio speak. What that means is if you hear us on your smart speaker, if you hear us on a podcast, if you hear us on the NPR One app, or if you hear us on the website or that good old-fashioned thing called radio, how we sound, how we promote ourselves, how we talk about ourselves, training and you know, listening back to shows and segments and stories with our colleagues and talking about what we can do, what we're doing well, what we can work on and improve. Those are all things that go into what a radio program director does. And it's a position that we haven't had at CAP Radio in a while. It's one we need as we grow. And we are, this is the great thing. We are growing so significantly at CAP Radio and making investments in journalism and insight and music in ways that we haven't before, haven't been able to before. But thanks to your support, we are able to. I'm going to be playing a role in the leadership of the content department, which encompasses news and news talk, which is insight and podcasts and music, all of that on, you know, classical jazz, modern music going forward.
There are a few things you do advocate for consistently, one being exactly what you're doing right now.
The way I frame it, and the end of my reporter's notebook story is in my nearly 20 years as a journalist, I've only ever felt comfortable advocating for two things. Support your public radio station and vote. But right now, I think I'm comfortable adding a third thing to that list, which is just because you disagree with someone's political views, it doesn't make them a bad person.
Let's wrap this up then with a little bit of a conversation that you had with a Senate fellow. It's interesting to talk to young people coming into the political world.
Yeah.
And give a little context to it, and then we'll hear some of the comment.
Sure. So the Sacramento State, which holds our license over at campus here, has a program called the Capitol Fellows Program. They've got Senate fellows, Assembly fellows, executive branch fellows, and judicial fellows. It's a great program. You take young people who come in every year and they, you know, fresh out of college, and you get some classroom experience, and then you get some real world legislative, executive, or judicial branch experience. Could be in media relations, could be in legislation, trying to write legislation, trying to lobby for it, any number of things. And as I started contemplating this story a couple of months ago after I knew that I was going to be leaving the state capitol beat, this was right after the legislative session had adjourned. You had the anti-vax protesters who were disrupting legislative session every day, day after day. You even had one person who I don't want to imply is reflective of everyone necessarily in that group, who threw a cup containing what appeared to be menstrual blood onto the floor. It struck senators. It made the Senate a crime scene on that final night of session. And there was just this uneasiness floating around the Capitol of, well, if a bill is going in a direction I don't like, what are the lengths I might go to, or what are the lengths someone else might go to try to defeat it? You had big battles over worker classification involving AB 5 and the dynamics. And so I wanted to talk to a brand new young person who had just completed a fellowship. And so Mina Hanin worked in a Democratic state senator's office. And on the final day of his fellowship last fall, he told me he started out viewing politics negatively because of TV and social media. But he learned that negotiating a bill with opponents often makes the measure stronger.
There's the human side of the person. There's the person themselves. And then there's their point of view. And productive negotiations and productive discussions come from the fact that you are negotiating the content, negotiating the issue, but you're not viewing the person negatively.
It is interesting to think about young people coming into politics in this era of the strife at all levels of government, the resistance. And yet, you know, Ben, sometimes the sparring you did with Governor Brown would end up being the highlight of a CAP chat or the highlight of a conversation. That kind of conversation would really stick in our minds and our memories.
Yeah, it's to some extent with Governor Newsom as well. That's the beauty of being a reporter. You get to ask these really powerful people hard questions. They don't always like it, or maybe they do like it. And I think Jerry Brown just genuinely loved being contrarian. So he would debate the weather with me. Or one time when I asked him what he was going to, you know, to be more clear about his fourth term agenda in 2014, he went off on a multi-minute rant saying that he has been upfront about his agenda and what he would do. In the end, he was not clear about how he a pledge he had made 4 years earlier about no new taxes without voter approval, that that only applied to that term, his third term, not his fourth. And he ended up signing a tax increase, a gas tax increase, without voter approval. One could argue that that is why reporters should ask questions and really try to pin politicians down. Very wily person, Jerry Brown. He knew what to say and what not to say and to keep his cards tightly held. And Newsom is a different person, just like, I mean, as I think everyone would expect. And he has his own ways of doing things. But yeah, you know, I'll miss that. I'll miss my colleagues here in the Cap Radio newsroom, even though I won't be very far from them. And I'll miss the pros at the state capitol, because there are a lot of pros in both parties, not just the lawmakers, but the staff. And I'll miss working with them as well.
Ben Adler, Cap Radio's new program director, saying goodbye to nearly a decade of covering California politics, but there's a lot of his work, including this story, still online at capradio.org, and Scott Rodd will still be there. So thank you. Good luck. Yes. And in all those ways, wish you a really happy new year, Ben.
Thank you. And we are committed to continuing to cover the Capitol. We're hiring a political reporter right now. So it is not just going to be Scott, although we are so thrilled to have Scott, and he's going to be great.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Maiña is the name of a clown in Cirque du Soleil's current touring show, Amaluna. The show debuted in 2018. It has a Sacramento run from January 22nd through February. And Kelsey Custard is the clown Maiña. She's a Sacramento native. She's in the midst of touring the world for this show. And now she's back home. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Did I say it right?
You did. Very impressive.
Glad to have you here. And you have brought a castmate with us. Do you want to do the introduction?
Sure.
Vladimir Pestov is here.
Yeah, he plays Callie, our kind of strange little imp of the island. And yeah, he does some pretty awesome things with balls, so.
Yeah.
Hi, but Kelly. Hi,
my
Vladimir.
Own. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So this is going to be a homecoming for you, Kelsey.
Yeah.
With a very big role, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty exciting.
How many of your classmates from grade school or high school would have said, yeah, I believe that Kelsey would have grown up to be a clown?
Oh, probably all of them. I've been a clown since I came out of the womb. So,
but clowning didn't actually become something you thought you could do until, if I get the story right, maybe a college class?
Yeah, yeah. I never knew clowning was actually a job that people could have. I had never seen the circus as a kid, so I didn't know that was an actual thing, so I was always in theater, but got those, like, funny little side roles. So when I found clowning in college, I was like, this is it. I'm home. I love it. And it's taken off from there.
Vladimir, give me your take on Kelsey as a clown. What is it about her that makes this the right fit?
So personally, I've worked with a bunch of clowns, a handful, and they were the top of the game, but Kelsey just beat them all.
Oh, wow.
Wow. I'm taking that quote.
I'm going to let you take that beyond maybe a friendship assessment, but what is it technically about her clowning that makes her great?
So because she comes from a theater background, having that experience combined with clowning hits home, basically. So instead of portraying something funny or making faces, she actually portrays a character, but in a funny way. You know how those Disney movies, you have these amazing like moments where the main character or the side character, for example, just, you know, you can relate to that person. Kelsey is one of those people, but in a live version of that character. Yeah.
How about that?
That's so sweet.
Yeah. Where did you go to high school? Where did you start doing theater?
I went to school in Shingle Springs in Ponderosa.
Okay.
So I started doing like community theater and high school theater, and then I just loved it so much. So I went to college at UC Santa Cruz to try to keep that going.
Clown school happened in San Francisco, mm-hmm. So becoming a clown may not be so unusual, but being a woman cast as a clown in Cirque du Soleil shows or any shows,
it's pretty
for
rare.
That matter.
Yeah, it's a hard business as a lady clown. I come up to a lot of people that think women aren't funny and that we can't do comedy. So it's been a struggle, but Cirque is slowly letting us kind of find our way in the comedic world. So,
and there's a lot of slapstick in this show,
yeah.
isn't there?
Yeah.
It's very physical. It's acrobatic. Let's talk about Amaluna and get a scene set, because there are a lot of women, more mm-hmm. women than usual in this show.
Yeah, we have a 70% cast of women. And actually, our general stage manager is a woman. Our head of rigging is a woman now.
We have an all-female band.
We have an all-female band. So it's a lot of pretty awesome ladies, not just on stage, but off stage as well.
So a tricky question, I think, is were this not a mostly female cast, would you still be cast as a clown? Did you get looked at for this role differently because of this type of show?
Ooh. That's a good question. I don't know. I would hope that I would still be considered, but...
I'm sure she would be considered because she kicks ass.
That's right. Yes. Yes, for sure.
So, Vladimir, I think you have some different perspective on this because your parents are longtime artists with
Cirque du
Soleil.
Yes, they have been with the company for 20 years and they have stopped being... acrobats, and now they are retired back home. My dad is a photographer. My mom is a full-time mom. I have a sister, and yeah, that's it.
So you saw your mom navigating roles. Because she was an acrobat, was it sort of gender neutral in being hired, or what do you think her experience was?
Well, first of all, my dad got casted because he was one of the best acrobats in the world at his time. And, well, still is. And my mom kind of followed him into the Cirque du Soleil world. She was also an acrobat and also at a high standard in Russia. And once they got in, they flowed into mm-hmm. different perspectives, yeah. I guess, you mm-hmm. know, into different roles and things like that. And I had the amazing opportunity to see that and see their growth in their professional career, and now I kind of I'm going through the same thing, through the same struggles, and I know what to expect next. Mm. You know, so I know all the layers of what is next. You know, it's really
let's honor them by saying their names.
Natalia Pestova and Alexander Pestov. Mm.
So you were a teenager when you started.
I was
performing.
A baby. I was 1 year old, but I was not
straight out of the womb.
Almost, yeah. I joined the cast, but I was not a performer until I was 18.
I am talking with Vladimir Pestova and Kelsey Custard, and we're talking about the show Amaluna that is coming to Sacramento January 22nd. It will be at Sutter Health Park, formerly known as Rayleigh Field. But this show doesn't come, or a big top show, doesn't come to Sacramento.
So this is
often.
The second one. The yeah. other one was in 2002, named Drowley
wow.
On, yeah.
Hmm. Wow.
Kelsey, say a little bit more about coming back home and being in front of friends and family, which I think is a different experience than doing the thing you do just yeah. out there in an audience that you might not know.
Yeah, it makes me so nervous. To be honest, you know, like when you're out in the world and I don't know the people that are watching, I can do whatever I want. Not whatever I want, but
it's a different freedom.
It's a different freedom. And then when you have people you know and love watching you, it's exciting and it's so wonderful, but it also has these bits of nerves because I want to live up to the expectation and I want them to see me at my best, and to like, I love this show so much, and this character for me is like probably the top of my game, you know. I mean, hopefully not, but it might be the peak of my career. So it's it's really nerve-wracking. Like, I've had teachers coming in San Francisco from my clown school coming to watch, and and it's, yeah, it's thrilling and terrifying all at once.
Your character and another cast member are sort of would-be lovers, and there's a lot of crazy humor between the two of you. That's not the only role you have in the show, though, is it? Is it the only character you appear in? Because I thought there were times when you have multiple characters, or...
I'm the same character throughout. There are some people in our show that are one character and kind of change and can do a few others. I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah, because as I said, it's a very large role. You're gymnastic in your role, theatrical, acrobatic.
Yeah.
The costume is great. You're a lot older in this show than you are in person.
Well, you know, I'm getting up there. It's the hair dye. It's the makeup.
The storyline, and maybe we should start with what the word Amaluna means, because the storyline evolves on a magical special island.
Yeah, so Ama stands for mother and Luna stands for moon. And it's actually the name of our island. So the show is loosely based on The Tempest. And it's about an island of women ruled by goddesses. And on their coronation day of the like beloved daughter of the island, in the middle of her coronation, a storm gets called and a boat of men crash onto the island. So that's when all the kind of comedy, love, tragedy ensues.
And you're a mischief maker on the island, aren't you, Vladimir?
Yes, I am. I'm the king of the lizard, the king of the protector of the island.
The creature.
The creature, yes.
Yeah. Or the like only Kelsey men on said, our island are creatures.
Yeah, so I get to see all the women. Protect them, I guess.
Protect us, yes.
This show was written and directed by Diane Paulus, who is a Tony Award-winning director. Choreography has to be so specific, and timing must be to the second. Where are you given freedom to sort of be, as you were saying, Vladimir, about Kelsey, the kind of clown or the kind of character that you are?
So I think timing and loose ends where we can actually create some stuff or things happen comes out sometimes out of nowhere, because sometimes, you know, this is our job, and sometimes, you know, there are times where we are missing our family, we don't want to be on stage, and sometimes some special moment happens and it is kept by the directors in the show, and it might be just a simple fling or a little wink to the audience, you know, or it depends on how you feel. And with that said, it's been 7 years. The show has been running and the cast has been changing overall. And imagine from the first product to where we came now, through all the little changes, through all the little mishaps, the amazing times and everything, you have the byproduct of an amazing quality show that is not, that you won't see anywhere else. It's been run over the years.
So this show actually started in 2013 then, but you joined the show, Kelsey, in
was it three and a half years ago,
okay,
so 2016
in the midst of the European tour. So how about you finding the place to kind of accordion your personality and how you are into your character?
Yeah, it's one of those things where I took over this role from a brilliant woman who created it, and I just can't do the things that she can do. We're two different humans. And so the whole show has evolved in that way. As new people come in, they have to be themselves. And especially for clowning, you have to be who you are. So they
really
let...
difficult.
Yeah.
It's really hard to stand on your own after having seen someone else do it.
Yeah.
People don't relate or cannot have something new because we get, you know, used to the old or to the, you know.
Yeah, so I kind of just went in and was like, it
and
has to be
everybody
for me. And I have to do it what's true to me, because the same jokes that she does, I couldn't do. And I have different jokes with my body type, my brain, my however I think. So
it's basically culture as well, because that woman is Brazilian. For example, I wouldn't be able to do the same thing as Kelsey because I'm Russian, for example, because we have a different type of mentality.
Yeah.
Let me wrap this up with a thought from each of you. We're at the beginning of a new year, a time when we try things new. We try to be inspired. We want to be hopeful. So with the path that you've chosen in your life and what you're doing, what is that message for you that you would want to share with others? Vladimir, I'll let you start about the work you do, the importance of it, and how to give that to another human being.
So I would say, in a little paraphrasing of one of my really, really good friends who is also an artist on a different show, he said that, you know, you go to the doctor for your health, right, when something's wrong. You go to the dentist when you have something, you know, so wrong with the teeth. You go to fix tires for your car to somebody, right? But there is one job in particular that you cannot redo or rehab with any other discipline, for example, other than theater or circus. And it's basically for the soul, you know. You want to get out. You want to get away from routine. You want to go out and have some fun. You want to forget yourself. You want to experience something new without having to take it in to your body as a hazard, or look at something, or be, you know, involved in dangerous activities. And you can experience the thrill that we have on stage, because once you're in it and you can relate, that's where the magic happens.
That's Vladimir Pestova. He is a mischief-making character, Callie, in the show Amaluna that opens in Sacramento January 22nd. All right, Kelsey, that's some good words to follow.
I mean, I think he's spot on and exactly how I feel. Like, you come to the circus and you come to see clowns, to laugh, to see yourself on stage, but to kind of forget all of your troubles and to be able to laugh at yourself and realize that no matter how serious and hard and sad life is, you can always laugh at it. So,
congratulations on your great career.
Thank you.
Welcome back home for this homecoming. We'll post a link that has pictures of the show, pictures of Kelsey as her clown role. And Amaluna opens on January 22nd at what was Rayleigh Field, now Sacramento's Sutter Health Park. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. We're back with another show tomorrow.